to the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you the first part of our aid evaluations event, looking at the performance of Australian Aid Report.
Thanks for coming. It's great to see so many people here for this evaluation forum. We were just talking outside, and I was reflecting that we had our first forum in 2012. So this is the fifth year now that we're doing it, and we've certainly got a lot more people coming along now than we did for the first one. So that's a vote of confidence. And the other change, you know, over time it's become really a co-hosted event with our friends at the Office of Development Effectiveness. So thank you very much to the ODE colleagues and to the Independent Evaluation Committee who also participate in this event. Last year we went from one to two of these fora, and let's see if we do that again this year. But it's certainly good they're fulfilling a role. Before we go any further, let's acknowledge and celebrate the first Australians, the traditional owners on whose land we're meeting, and let us pay our respects to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, past and present. The format for today, it's kind of standard. I guess we've set it over the last few years. We normally look at two reports. They're normally from ODE, but not necessarily. And today there's one that's not from ODE, from the aid management part of DFAT. That's the Performance of Australian Aid Report, and we'll begin with that. And Scott Dawson will be presenting that, and I'll be giving a few comments. We try to leave lots of time for discussion, so I hope you get a chance to ask a question or make a comment. And then we take a break for morning tea, and then the second report, it is an ODE report. It's the one on scholarships and women's leadership, and that will be presented by Karen Ovington. Then we ask someone from DFAT to kind of give the DFAT response to the report, and Cheryl Johnson, who's Assistant Secretary for Scholarships, will be doing that. And then we bring in an academic, an independent commentator to comment on the report, its findings, recommendations, DFAT's response, whatever he or she would like. And we've got Rose Amazan, who, thank you very much, Rose, for coming. I think it's also a first to have someone from outside the ANU come and provide that, play that role of the expert, independent expert. Rose is from the University of New England. So thanks for joining us. So these are the two reports. The two chairs for the different sessions are Stephen Creese. Stephen is one of the members of the Independent Evaluation Group that oversees the work of the ODE, plays a very important role. He'll be chairing the first session. And then after morning tea, Simon Ernst. Simon's the acting director of ODE. We're missing Derek Rookinsmith today. He's stepped down. We understand Peter Vasigi will be taking over, but in the meantime, thanks a lot, Simon. The last thing I'm going to say, normally we wrap up with some reflections from the head of the Independent Evaluation Group. That's Jim Adams. Jim comes all the way from the US, so we're really grateful to him. He also guest lectured to my students, so I'm particularly grateful this time, Jim, for your efforts. Jim is about, he has to leave a bit early to get on a flight to go to Tanzania, which is a long way away. So we're going to ask him, instead of making, I think he'll be with us most of the morning, yeah, but not right to the end. So instead of giving the closing remarks, we'll ask you to kick off proceedings right now. So please welcome Jim Adams.
Actually, I have to join Steve in complimenting the audience. I don't think there are many places where evaluation gets this level of attention in the development side, and I think it's very much a compliment to the work Stephen and his team have done to facilitate this interest. I just want to talk a little bit about the system because I thought I'd set a framework for the discussions because I do think Australia has put in place over the last 5 years quite an effective system. When Derek Rokin-Smith took over the responsibility 5 years ago, there was a sense that the evaluation function was not working the way it was intended. Stephen, at that point, when I assumed responsibility, it was very critical that nothing was being produced. And I think what's happened with Rokin and his team, many of whom are here, is the ODE team has actually emerged in the context of both meeting operational targets in terms of producing good strategic work, but also working very closely with the aid management side, and Scott Dawson is here representing that, within the internal systems of the DFAT, to make sure that the discussions of quality at the project level, the systems that review quality, the systems that review quality at the country level are reinforced and strengthened. So I think the present system is really quite robust. The team now produces 4 or 5 strategic reports a year. Those reports are all publicized, so everything is transparent. I think that's an important part of ODE's function. But in addition to ODE within the DFAT, there is also the requirement and the very large program of operational evaluations that are actually done by operational staff. And they, in fact, number around 50 a year. It's much larger. There have been reviews of those each of the past 2 years. The quality certainly has improved. That was a concern. What was the quality of these? One of the things ODE is trying to do is get more involved in those large studies to make sure qualities and standards meet high evaluation standards. So you have not only ODE, but you also have a very robust level of evaluations within the operational side of the DFAT. And so I think you have now, I think Australia has a very impressive system of ensuring that evaluation is done, it's done properly, and the results are disseminated. And that this level of attention here, I think, perhaps indicates a level of listening, which is important. I think the two challenges and the balance that the team has worked hard within ODE to do is ensure both accountability in the analysis, to ensure there's honest judgments about what's working and what's not, but also to serve an important learning function, that the results and the analysis that's done actually feeds back to staff. I think that's very much a work in progress. A lot of effort is being made, and particularly now an effort is being made to ensure the operational evaluations, the lessons from that also feed back into the work. Money is being spent, and I think it's important that it be maximized. I think as one looks forward, the system, I don't know how to politely put this, has both survived and thrived in the context of all the changes, both the change in government and obviously the organizational changes. I'll be honest, in IEC, we had a lot of concerns when the change was made, what level of priority would be given to evaluation and how the evaluation system that was then still emerging would be supportive. I think at least in this part of the Australian aid system, I can reassure people that in fact, the team has gotten continued support from management, continued to get the resources that are necessary to fully deliver on a larger program. So I think that's the system. I think the system is working. And I think everyone would be very proud that that system exists, because I think relative to most bilateral systems, this is a much stronger and more robust system, at least in my experience. On the discussion today, I just wanted to do a couple things. Certainly, again, I want to thank the leadership ANU has played in terms of facilitating this discussion. I want to emphasize that one of the problems you always have in evaluation is evaluators are criticizing. The people who are criticized have a very strong instinct to respond and correct. That's in the nature of evaluation. Similarly, when people comment on evaluation, you have the same framework. So I want to certainly encourage people to raise questions and be critical, and from the positive sense that one, in terms of the studies, you're holding the evaluators responsible, that I think is important. But that this cycle of criticism, response, and the lessons that learned from that are, in fact, in my view, one of the most important part. When I worked at the World Bank, I always felt accountability was always given too much emphasis. It's very easy to criticize. But if you can actually generate constructive discussions, if you can actually produce learning, the value of evaluation is, in fact, much more important than if you simply focus on accountability. So I want to thank everybody who's here, but I also want to thank all the speakers, and I'm looking forward to an interesting discussion of what I think two very interesting reports on both performance and then on the specific area that will be discussed in the second report. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Stephen Creese. I'm a member of the Independent Evaluation Committee. Jim chairs that committee, and Wendy Jarvie is also a member of that committee. She's actually 2 floors up at the moment teaching. My background, just very briefly, is I probably describe myself now as a not-for-profit independent director. I'm a senior fellow at the University of Melbourne Law School, and I teach a course there in international minerals law. But I come from a private sector background, which I bring, I think, to the committee. I must say, this morning I was very, very excited when I was actually able to get a hard copy of the performance of Australian Aid. I think they've already disappeared from outside. Must be betraying my age, but trying to deal with soft copies of these documents, I find, is quite difficult. And I really like to have something like this, which I think is... It's a tribute to this document to the people who put it together, because there's an enormous amount of work, as we know, because we got to look at this over the Christmas New Year period somewhat intensively as we settled our quality assurance and verification statement that we provided with respect to that report. And Scott Dawson, who is our speaker, who is going to present this report, is the person who is responsible for pulling all of this together. And Scott has appeared here a number of times, so I think it's probably well known to you, but briefly, Scott is the First Assistant Secretary of the Contracting and Age Management Division in DFAT. He's been a very long-term person within the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, starting there in 1980, which is also the year I started my first serious corporate role. And has worked also with the World Bank, and he also headed the AusAid team in Port Moresby in the mid-90s. I think it's public, Scott, but he is going to be taking up a role for 3 years now with the Asian Development Bank commencing in July. So I think this is a great opportunity to thank him for the work that he's done in this area in particular, and to wish him well in this further appointment. I won't dwell on this any further other than just simply to say that we're expecting that Scott will present for about half an hour, and then Stephen Howes will provide a commentary, and then after that we'll have a Q&A session, which I will then try and moderate in terms of making sure everybody gets an opportunity to ask what I think will be quite a number of questions. So I'd now like to ask Scott to come and give his presentation. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Stephen, and good morning and welcome, everybody. So if I can figure out how to drive this machine. What I was going to do today was briefly kind of outline the overall performance framework for the aid program, spend most of the time talking about the findings of the report, and then just a little bit talking about how we use performance information and some reflections on ways that we can further strengthen that. So the performance framework overall, I think many of you will know this was announced by the Minister Julie Bishop in June 2014. The main feature of it is the introduction of a new set of 10 strategic targets, but there were a few other innovations in terms of performance measures, particularly this introduction of performance benchmarks at the country program level, and also for the first time systems of assessment of key delivery partners. And of course the commitment was that we would produce this annual report on the performance of Australian Aid, and this is the second of those reports. That's a very busy and hard to read graphic, but all I really wanted to draw attention to there was that last year we were basically presenting the performance framework as having three levels, and I'm not sure if this works. I can't quite see whether I can see that or not, but anyway, the top level up here, the sort of whole of aid program level, that's where the strategic targets come in. The second level of programs, country programs, global programs, we've got different sorts of reporting systems that apply in each of those. Down at the level of individual investments, assessed against a set of kind of standard effectiveness or standard aid quality criteria, which are well used internationally. But what we've added to this is a set of assessments about key aid delivery partners. So we've got really sort of four levels in the performance framework. We follow an exercise a bit like painting the harbour bridge. So we, as soon as we finish, we start again. At the moment, we're sort of sitting in the quality reporting season at the individual investment level. That goes through later in the year to looking at kind of overall programs and the performance of those programs. Throughout the year, there's evaluation reports being prepared, and then at the end of the year, we pull together, based on all of that kind of information, the Performance of Australian Aid report. So just kind of a couple of other comments about that. We continue to have very high levels of compliance. So 99% of eligible investments go through this system. 92% of agreements with partners go through this system as well. The one area that some work to do on compliance is down here at the operational evaluation level. We think that about 70 of these were done in the last year, but only 19 of them were published. And so there's some work to do in terms of lifting the transparency of that reporting. So onto the report itself. Last year, there are four kind of main chapters in the report, one that deals with the strategic targets, another with country and regional programs, the third with global program performance, and then a fourth with sector and thematic performance. And the performance assessments in the report have been quality assured by the Office of Development Effectiveness and the Independent Evaluation Committee that Stephen and Jim are on. They kind of oversee that process. I think there are five kind of key messages out of the overall body of performance information in the report. They are that the progress against the strategic targets is very good. Seven of them have been achieved. Two of them are on track. Only one of them hasn't yet been achieved on gender equality. The performance at kind of country and regional program level basically holding steady. Similar kind of results against objectives for those programs. For the first time, we're looking at the delivery partner performance, and that's adequate or better in all areas. Investment level performance continues to be assessed very positively. And for this report, we've got a much wider range of performance information gathered than we've ever had before. And I'll go into that a little bit more later on. So very quickly, that's the list of the 10 targets, and I'll just run through those sort of very quickly. So the first one was about increasing proportion of expenditure going on aid for trade investments, and they are things like economic infrastructure, agriculture, trade facilitation, some aspects of economic governance, and the aim is to get that to 20% of the overall budget by 2020. It's lifting, and we think that that's sort of safely on track. The second one was about looking at ways to promote private sector growth or engage the private sector in all of our new investments. So there's a process in place to do that, so we're counting that as achieved. The third one was about constructing or preparing aid investment plans, which you might sort of consider to be country strategy documents that describe how Australia's aid will promote economic growth in ways that provide pathways out of poverty. So it was a fairly sort of procedural target, and those aid investment plans have all been completed and published. So we're counting that as achieved as well. The fourth target was about empowering women and girls, and it was a target to lift the performance of all of our aid investments, regardless of their objectives, so that they effectively address gender issues in their implementation. Historically, this has been a difficult target to improve, and we still haven't got to the target level of 80%. However, there's been a very sort of significant effort over the last year to improve our gender performance. A strategy, a dedicated team, a lot of work with individual program areas to improve the performance of their programs and individual investments. The scores haven't improved. But one thing that we are quite pleased with, which comes through in the ODE comments in the report, is that the robustness of the scores is significantly better. So when we talk about robustness of scores, what we're really talking about is the score backed up by evidence? So can someone independent looking at the material identify that there's the sufficient evidence there to justify the scoring? And that was traditionally a fairly poor area of performance, but it's got significantly better, so that we're now confident that our scores on gender are as robust as other scores. And in some areas, that's made had quite a significant impact. The infrastructure area is one in particular that had very poor quality of our assessments. That's really been lifted quite significantly over the last year. The fifth target was about the focus on the Indo-Pacific region in terms of budget allocations, to get to 90% going to that region. That has been achieved in the 14-15 budget, and certainly we expect the final figures for 15-16 to be kind of well above that level. The sixth target was about commitments, but particularly about progress against mutual obligations, which is something which we have attempted to write into our agreements with partner governments and our agreements with major partner organisations. And so there's reporting on that, which is in this year's individual aid program performance reports at the individual country level, and there's some material on that in this report. So we're counting that one as achieved as well. Working with the most effective partners, we did a lot of work during this year just gone to introduce a new sort of system of assessments of individual partners and their performance in terms of carrying out agreements. We brought in a new multilateral performance assessment system. There were a number of reforms made to our agreements with NGO partners, and on the commercial side, a lot of emphasis on linking performance to payments in our contractual agreements. So we think that one's achieved as well. Value for money. The idea was that we get to at least 85% of aid investments assessed as performing effectively against effectiveness and efficiency. We've got there. Another part of this target was that underperforming investments would be identified for particular attention, and if they didn't improve, they'd be cancelled within a year. So we're now looking at the kind of the first year of performance. We had 18 investments which a year ago were assessed as underperforming, and we're currently going through a process of looking at their performance over the last year, and fully expect that a number of those will be concluded because they haven't improved. Consolidation. This really arose as a target from the idea that the more fragmented an aid program is, the more individual activities that our country partners need to be dealing with and reacting to, the higher the administrative burden on them. We have evidence as well that for larger investments overall, their performance is stronger than for smaller investments. And so the process of consolidating the program for fewer, larger investments is something which the government wanted to establish a target on. You see on the left-hand side of the graph there, the dark blue bars, that is the progress in terms of reducing the number of investments. And so we're very close to the target, which is that light blue bar in the middle by the end of this financial year. On the right-hand side, we're just also tracking the number of agreements that we have. So each individual investment will often have agreement with a number of individual implementing partners. Those agreement numbers are also sort of falling rapidly. So again, I think we've got a little while to actually get to that target, or this year to get to that target level, but we certainly think clearly on track. And the final target was about combating corruption and the preparation of fraud and corruption strategies, which have been done. So just to delve into sort of some of these things in a little bit more detail, every year we look at the performance of our programs against their individual objectives. And we've just, for convenience, got to group together all of the programs in the Pacific, East Asia, South and West Asia, and Africa and the Middle East. And you can see that the performance in 14-15, very similar in terms of to 13-14. So not a lot of change between objectives which are assessed as being on track and those that are assessed as not on track or at risk. Performance benchmarks. So I mentioned that this was sort of something which was new, which had been brought in as part of the new performance framework. This was the first year of working with these. I'll show a little bit more kind of what the sort of some examples of what these things are later, but there were 189 of these individual benchmarks which were being assessed. There was a good spread across different sectors and a good spread according to kind of the size of programs. So larger programs had more benchmarks, smaller ones less. 64% achieved, 32% partially achieved, only a very small number not achieved at all. One thing which we're certainly conscious of is that these benchmarks comprise a range of different sorts of measures of performance. Some are very kind of simple output measures, some are more complicated outcome or policy reform type measures. And we certainly kind of want to shift the emphasis over time more to the outcome and policy change type away from kind of the more simple outputs. But a good start, I think, has been made. That's what it looks like on a regional basis. So as you can see, not a lot of difference between different regions. The kind of the proportion of achieved versus partly achieved and not achieved, very similar kind of region to region. These are the sorts of benchmarks and sorts of examples. So you see they range from things like at output level, setting a target of a number of schools having water and sanitation facilities, through to kind of policy reform about agreeing a quite complicated policy reform matrix in the kind of the economic and financial area with an individual government. And as I said, we're trying to kind of move the emphasis or the kind of the weighting of these benchmarks much more towards the outcome and the policy side and away from output side. But that'll take time, and you'll probably still have a reason to include kind of a number of output measures there as well. Investment performance overall, not a lot different to the kind of the pattern of previous years. You see monitoring and evaluation, gender equality. These have been traditionally the kind of the weakest areas of investment performance, and they continue to be so. I think there are some issues around kind of year-to-year performance, and I'm sure Stephen might kind of talk about some of those things, and I'm happy to come back and talk about that in a little bit more detail. But the pattern in terms of the kind of the main quality measures, very similar to previous years. It's interesting to look at some of the kind of the best and worst areas of performance. If you look at effectiveness, for example, that's the sort of the second one in the list. You see that the most effectively or the best performing sector in the program is education. So that's good because it's the largest sector. That's certainly how we'd expect it to be. The fact that the worst sort of performing sector on effectiveness is agriculture, fisheries and water. A lot of that, I think, points to how agricultural research activity is actually applied in practice. So there's a job of work there to kind of think about that. Monitoring and evaluation, so that's in the middle. Infrastructure, kind of the best sort of performing sector, quite understandable because it's often a lot more kind of quantifiable and easier to measure. Building resilience, This is the first time that we've tried to bring the kind of humanitarian interventions into our performance framework, and it's perhaps not surprising that there's still kind of more work to do in just improving the systems for M&E around humanitarian interventions in particular. Gender equality, another interesting one, the sort of the second one from the bottom, if I can get the... Sorry, I keep losing where the pointer goes, but the second one from the bottom, you see again education, kind of much better performing sector in terms of building gender effectiveness measures into individual investments. Infrastructure, a long way to go. Gender equality, we looked at the performance of investments according to whether they had principal or significant gender objective or no gender objective, and the interesting thing is that the light blue bar, investments that had a principal or significant gender objective, it outperforms investments under every criteria. So it's quite clear that if you've got a gender objective, then I think it means that you're probably paying more attention to kind of a range of other impacts and other effectiveness issues. And so it's dragging up scores overall. But it's just an interesting correlation. Disability, this is the first time that we've had a look at disability inclusion in the program. And the results are probably not what you'd consider great. So there's quite a lot of work overall to do. But it's interesting to look at the variation between different areas. So education, I think a lot more progress has been made in terms of disability inclusion in school systems. Infrastructure, down at the bottom, worst performing area. A lot of work still to do, I think, on that one. We also looked at innovation. This was the first time, again, that we'd measured performance against this criteria. Again, the sort of up at the top, the aid for trade areas are kind of clearly outperforming. Perhaps surprisingly, down at the bottom, education, a bit of a reverse from sort of the disability picture. Not as much innovation in the education area as in others. I should have said the kind of questions that we're asking, which these things measure, set out at the bottom, probably a little bit hard to read, but on disability, we were asking, for example, whether investment identifies barriers to inclusion and opportunities for participation for people with a disability. That was the dark blue bar, and the light blue one, we're asking whether the investment actively involves disabled people's organisations in the planning, implementation, monitoring and evaluation. And on innovation, we were asking whether the investment's trialling or adapting new technologies, and that's the dark blue bar, and the light blue one, whether it's applying approach to aid delivery that hasn't been used in that sort of sector or region before. So one of the things, one of the big changes that we had made in the investment level performance system over the last year was to introduce a range of sub-criteria. In the past, if we were scoring against gender equality, we simply had one single score and then a lot of kind of textual description about how investments were performing. It wasn't a system that we could use to interrogate, to find out why a particular investment sort of wasn't performing so well on gender equality scores. Was it because they weren't doing any kind of initial baseline data? Was it because they weren't providing additional sort of separate dedicated resources to it? We're now asking these sorts of questions across kind of all of the aid quality criteria. And some interesting things come through when we start to analyse this. This isn't in the report. This is sort of some of the stuff which we've done since the report was issued. But clearly kind of disability inclusion is one of the kind of the areas of weakest overall performance. There are some questions, I think, around sustainability that come through there, whether the investments have a clear exit strategy, whether there are other sources of funding which can be expected to continue to support outcomes after the the development assistance funding is finished. So we're going to continue to look at these sort of sub-criteria scores and make some conclusions about that, which will hopefully lead to more dedicated action to kind of fix the kind of weaknesses in these areas. But it's been a big change in the investment level reporting. One last slide again, which isn't in the report, which is a bit of analysis that we've done since. This just really sort of supports the kind of the consolidation effort. So you see the dark blue bar, that's investments over $50 million, the medium colour between 10 and 50, and the light blue bar under 10. In each case, I think bar one, the larger the investment, the stronger the performance. I said we'd set up a new system of assessing performance by partner type, and there's a reasonable spread across our main three groups of partners, non-government organisations, commercial contractors and multilateral organisations. They're all performing at least adequately or better. There's a little bit of difference between, on the bottom, I guess, between... I can't quite see where this is going, but between commercial partners, NGOs and multilateral organisations, multilaterals, not as strong as expected, but we're saying treat this with a little bit of caution because kind of the nature of our relationship with multilateral organisations is in fact more of a partnership partnership relationship, but I think sometimes investment managers kind of want to treat them a bit like contractors and are a little bit disappointed when they don't behave accordingly. So I think that's probably part of the kind of the story behind the difference in scores. I said that we had introduced a new system of performance assessment for our core funding of multilateral organisations. A few years ago, we had a single big bang approach to this. We did every organisation in 1 year in a big multilateral performance report. That wasn't a sustainable system. What we've tried to do now is to link the assessments of performance to our regular review of our partnership arrangement with those organisations so that what we're expecting and what's happening in terms of performance is feeding into a discussion about funding. And we've put four organisations through this process in the last year, the ADB, World Food Programme, UNICEF and UN Development Programme. They all came up well against all of our criteria. We've got a number of other organisations, first of all with the World Bank, which are sort of proceeding through this system in this year. And what this is giving us is a standardised system for assessing the performance of these organisations. Lastly, just a couple of comments about transparency. I think this was an area that in the commentary on the same report last year, Stephen certainly picked up on and suggested that we needed to provide some more information on. There's some information in the report, and it basically talks about the kind of information which is now publicly available. I won't kind of go through all that in detail, but you can see the information there. I just note that the relevant ministers released a new Green Book, which is a report on Australia's engagement with developing countries, both on the aid side, but also covering a range of other measures of bilateral engagement, trade and investment, tourism, labour movement, tertiary students, diaspora involvement. So there's quite a lot of information in that report as well. So that's the main elements of the report itself. How are we using this information? So basically five ways to improve our existing investments, to inform the design of new investments, to inform our program strategy and our planning, to inform the kind of dialogue that we have on policy and performance issues with our partners, both at the country level and at the aid delivery level, and to inform funding decisions. I said that we've made a range of changes to our quality reporting in the last year. You see most of them there. So this was the first time we brought humanitarian aid into this system. The first time that we've looked at quantifying performance against issues of risk management and safeguards. We brought a whole lot more of kind of value for money considerations into the way in which we were assessing performance. There's a lot more detailed information on results as a result of us introducing these kind of sub-criteria. So we've got a lot more information which we can analyse in different ways. For the first time, we're looking at these measures of innovation, disability, private sector engagement. We've substantially strengthened kind of our end of investment reporting with a thing called final aid quality checks, which is done in the last year of an investment. And we've got standardised ratings and standardised assessment of partner performance. Lastly, what are the areas that we need to do better on? So one of the commentaries in the Independent Evaluation Committee's comment on the performance of Australian Aid report is, in effect, you've done well against the 10 targets. They're clearly sort of driving performance, but a number of them have been achieved. It's about time that you had another look at them and refreshed them. So that's something which we will be doing in the near term. We're looking at things like how do we bring the 2030 agenda and the sustainable development goals into our performance reporting arrangements, looking at, you know, whether we need to go harder on the kind of the consolidation agenda, whether we can be more specific about things like fraud control, disability, inclusive growth, how might we kind of provide some targets at the overall level to deal with those sorts of issues. So there are a number of kind of options on the table, and we're just working out whether these are things which we can feasibly measure at a whole of program level. I think, as we've noted, there are some sort of persistent poor performing areas, gender equality, monitoring and evaluation, disability inclusion, now that we've looked at it, is clearly in the same category. So we're very focused on how do we use the new information that we've got to better improve scores in those areas. I think another kind of comment which was made by the Independent Evaluation Committee was, in effect, interesting report, but where's the bad news? We accept that, we'll do a better job next year of trying to identify the areas where performance is markedly less than was expected, and to give more attention to that in the report itself. How do we make use of evaluations? How do we make use of final performance reports? That's sort of something which is on our agenda as well. I mentioned the issue of the kind of transparency of operational evaluations. We're doing quite a lot of them, but we're not publishing them. So that's sort of something which, again, we'll focus on. Looking at performance benchmarks, how do we make that shift more from kind of outputs level reporting more to kind of outcomes type reporting? I think there are some issues around sustainability. It performs, our scores are very high at the investment level, but clearly when we looked at kind of the sub-criteria, there are some issues around what is sustainability actually measuring. So we'll look to do a little bit more work on that. And we're certainly looking to use our performance reporting better to inform the discussions with partners. And then all of these things which the changes that we made last year, a number of them have got the odd bug in it that we just need to bed down during the course of this year. So that's basically our agenda for future work. So I'll stop at that point.
Well, thank you very much, Scott, for that most cogent, comprehensive and articulate presentation. We're now going to ask Professor Stephen House, who really needs no introduction as Director of this Development Policy Centre, to provide a commentary. And then I think at the end of that, Scott, you might, before we start the Q&A, you may want to have a little right of reply, but we'll see how we're travelling. So please, Stephen House, if you come provide your commentary. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Sorry for not being more organized. It's me again. I feel I should apologize because it's, you know, I'm hogging the floor in the commentary. But I'll just say I did, at our Australasian Aid Conference, I invited the entire group to, I drew their attention to this report that had just come out. I invited the entire group. I suggested someone should write a commentary on it. Unfortunately, no one did, so that's why you're stuck with me. But I do want to say it's great to see so many people here. I do encourage you to think about writing a blog for us on one of these evaluations. They're very interesting documents. They're very important documents, and often feel, you know, we don't play our part in this kind of bargain, that DFAT is still producing a lot of interesting reports, and we should, sometimes they come out and there's no response at all. So I encourage you to take up that challenge, and I hope next year we'll have someone else who can provide the commentary on this report instead of me. Second introductory remark I want to make is that I know, you know, we have a reputation here for perhaps being a bit critical of the reports that come out. We're always negative. So I just want to say last year when I gave the commentary on this report, I was very positive about it. I said last year, I think it was the fifth performance report that AusAid had brought out under different names and different arrangements, and I commented that a lot of the earlier ones have been very delayed. You know, they were 12, 18 months sort of overdue, whereas this one came out in a very timely way, and that it drew on a lot of aid, this aid performance data that Scott's been talking about. We were critical of earlier reports, they kind of ignored that data. So I just want to remind you, we're very positive about last year's report, and I want to start off, before I go into my criticisms of this year's report, I want to start off with some positive positive response to the report, and also what Scott said. I mean, I think there's a real hunger or thirst, depending on which metaphor you want, for information about the aid program among stakeholders. And this report fills that gap, and having someone like Scott come to an event like this also fills that gap. And I think that's great, and it's very valuable. You know, there's a lot of extremely useful information in this report, which will provide the basis for questions. And I'm very happy if you direct your questions to Scott, because I think it's a good opportunity. But I'll just, since I've got the floor, you know, I wanted to ask about consolidation. You know, I've been, you know, in the various reviews I've been involved with, always in favour of consolidation. It's kind of standard aid doctrine. But, you know, I'm sure you're aware there's also a lot of talk, you know, about whether DFAT is outsourcing the aid program. Right? This has come up especially in relation to Fiji, where there seems to be a kind of very comprehensive tender put out, which, you know, you can crudely interpret as you're asking a company to run the aid program for you. And in PNG, they've moved to this mega governance facility, which is worth about $500 million, I think, over 4 years. It's a huge facility, taking over four. And we're actually, you know, we're a subcontractor now, or we will become a subcontractor to that facility. And so from a consolidation point of view, you know, that's one big activity. You are consolidating the program, but are you actually reducing the transaction costs, or are you actually increasing the transaction costs? Right? It's what we found is that, you know, this approach is fine if everyone starts at the same time, right? Or the sub-activities start at the same time as the main contract. But of course, that's not what happens, right? Sub-activities come along all the time. We've come along with our UPNG partnership, which we've been asked to do by the government, but with only about a year and a half of the main contract to go. So, you know, we're told, well, this is a three-year project. In fact, we want to go for more than 3 years. But, you know, there's only 1 year funding. Of course, you'll be transferred to another contractor. But in the meantime, that's a major source of risk for us. And it's a major source of transaction costs, because we have to constantly, well, when are you going to transfer the contract? And then we have to negotiate again. So, yeah, I think it'd be good to just reflect on that whole, to what extent is the strategy of DFAT now to outsource aid program management? And what are the costs and benefits of that? That's the kind of discussion that we can have with this information. I think that's really, really useful. All right, now let me, I don't want to take up too much time, let me go on to my criticisms of this report, why I'm not as positive. I guess this report has the same positive features as last year, but kind of now we take that for granted and look for where it could be improved more. I got 2 points I want to make. One is about the text. So the first 20 pages are on those 10 targets, but then there's about 80 pages of text, which is very detailed discussion going through the aid program by region, partner, and sector. And it starts off in this quite a sober way, as Scott mentioned, about one-third of aid objectives are at risk of not being met, right? One-third. So you'd expect to see a text that was fairly balanced between the positives and the negatives. But in fact, as I think Scott has sort of admitted towards the end, the text doesn't read that way at all. And to give you, it's a crude measure, but on the Pacific, right, where 45% of program objectives are still at risk, right? And the Pacific is a very hard region to work in. I think the foreign minister, when she came in, you know, said it's not acceptable, we're going to change everything, and perhaps now is discovering it's much harder to change the effectiveness of aid than she thought. 45% of program objectives are classified at risk, but there are 4 pages of text on the Pacific. There are 35 positive comments and 4 negative comments. Right? So the text doesn't match up with the numbers. And, you know, to be honest, this might sound harsh, but the text is thoroughly spun. Right? So I'll just give you 2 examples of how this happens. TB is a big problem in several countries in the Pacific. It's a big problem in Kiribati. But Kiribati is making progress, and so that is cited as a good story. But we know TB in PNG is a huge problem. It's, despite massive investments by Australia, it's not under control. There was just the background briefing by Joe Chandler the other week. So TB in PNG simply isn't mentioned. Right? So that's not like we're picking up Kiribati as a random sample. Right? That's selective, using selective examples. Another type of spin is sort of selective quotation. So one project I'm familiar with is the Australia Pacific Technical College, APTC, which was set up to improve technical education but also to promote labour mobility. There's just been an independent evaluation, and the report draws on that independent evaluation to make a positive comment about APTC. APTC has helped improve standards of technical education and training through partnerships with national institutions. And you know, the evaluation does find that. But the evaluation also finds that APTC has a negative net present value, right? That its rate of return is below sort of what's considered the acceptable threshold. You know, that's a very damning comment about a project, and that simply isn't mentioned. Right? So it's take the good news, but omit the bad news. So I guess to an extent Scott's conceded this point, but I do think a more robust, balanced text would help. Of course, you know, it's a government document, but as independent, interested observers, we're always going to be pushing for that balance and honest review. Then my second comment is around these targets. Of course, overall targets, they're doing extremely well, but, you know, the alarm bells kind of ring a little bit. When you get to the end of the report, now the ODE gives their commentary. That's a very good practice. I commend the aid program having that practice that, all right, it's a government review, but we're going to allow a somewhat independent body to give their comment on it. That's a very good practice. It brings out the fact or the claim. It makes the claim that there have been changes in the wording in this 6-point quality scale, right, on things like effectiveness and efficiency, and that therefore the proportion of investments rated as satisfactory should be treated with caution. So kind of it rings the alarm bell. And this is my one slide. So I made this slide. You can't actually find this slide in the report, right? Although you could find the time series in the last year's report, but that time series has been dropped, and I guess that itself is... you know, it rings a bit of an alarm bell, but you can see there has been this big improvement here in effectiveness, right? Oh, sorry, in efficiency. In fact, there's been a big improvement in both, right? In both efficiency and effectiveness compared to the previous several years. Right? And the efficiency wouldn't have met the target if there hadn't been that improvement, right? The effectiveness was already there, but the efficiency has met the target. Now, if that's true, if the reason for this improvement is not actually improved efficiency, but a different standard, well, then we want to know that. We want to understand what's really going on. And it's unfortunate that isn't discussed in the main body of the report. There's a comment, I think, in the ODE commentary that this will be addressed next year. That's good. But I did, when Jim wrote that this report was sound and credible, and I looked at this graph and some of that commentary, I'm not so sure myself. That said, you know, even if on the historical approach, you know, maybe this, you haven't met the target. I mean, clearly they're close to meeting the target, and not every aid program is going to succeed. So, you know, I'm not, you know, desperately worried about this. It's more a matter of being transparent about how you're doing it. Overall, as Scott said, it's true. Most of these targets either have been met or they're going to be met. And so we do need to have a new set of targets, and it's great that's on the agenda. So I just want to finish with some thoughts about what those new targets might look like. One of the things I think that's attractive about the current set of targets is that they are quite within the control of the aid program to meet. Right? They're not about the MDGs. They're things like where we're focusing the aid program, how many projects we're, you know, the issue of consolidation. They're things that are relatively easy to measure, and they're relatively within the control of the aid program. I think those are two very attractive features. And I get a bit nervous when Scott said they're going to, you know, realign the targets with the 2030 agenda and the SDGs, because, of course, the SDGs cover everything and is well beyond the aid program. So I encourage DFAT to stick with this type of target. But in terms of specifics, you know, we did, around the same time as this report came out, we brought out our stakeholder survey of the aid program. And, of course, the stakeholder survey painted a very different picture. This is a very rosy picture of the aid program. Stakeholder survey really rang the alarm bell in terms of a perceived deterioration in effectiveness compared to the last one we did, which was a couple of years ago. Now, of course, as we say, you know, the aid program's been cut massively, and no doubt there's a sort of unhappiness about that, and that feeds through into the commentary made by stakeholders. But even if you discount for that, I think the stakeholder survey is very useful in highlighting the sort of issues that it would be good to target. So one example is transparency. And transparency is covered very briefly in one paragraph, right? But there's no sense of, you know, what's our target on transparency and are we achieving the target? And if you look at the stakeholder survey, there's a clear sense, well, the message is, because we asked stakeholders about 20 different attributes apart from their overall perspective. And transparency is perceived to have gone from being a strength of the program to a weakness. And that's not something that you can easily explain in terms of aid cuts. So stakeholders clearly think transparency has gone backwards, and based on my own analysis, I would agree with that. So I think you know, transparency would be something very good to have as one of the benchmarks, to have as one of the targets, and to then set some hard targets, something you can control within the aid program, and then that will, you know, give greater impetus to the commitment to transparency. And we'll be able to then, you know, we hope, show stakeholders, well, transparency is doing well. Another one that the stakeholder survey points to is the staff rotation, staff turnover. This is not a new weakness. This was perceived as the biggest weakness in the first stakeholder survey, and it's perceived as the biggest weakness now. Under the, you know, 2011-2012 framework, staff continuity was one of the benchmarks. And again, it's something that's under the control of the government. And I would, I think that's, it should come back. It's still a problem, obviously. It's very important for aid effectiveness to have continuity of staff in positions. That would be another possible benchmark. The stakeholder survey points to staff expertise as something that's seen to be in decline and a concern. That's more difficult to measure. Staff expertise, but I'm sure, well, I think it'd be at least worth thinking through whether you can come up with a good measure of staff expertise. So this might sound like self-promotion, but I would suggest that the stakeholder survey provides a good source of possible targets in any thinking about a refresh of the performance framework. So to conclude, I'd say a more balanced text and some more challenging targets would further improve this report or next year's report. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for your commentary. I think before we move to the Q&A, I'm just going to ask Scott, is there anything you'd like to say as a preliminary way before we move to the Q&A session?
Thanks, Stephen. I might take up the offer. If we can go back to my presentation, I've actually got a few other slides that I didn't use that I might just bring in at this point. But just essentially four things that I'd just like to pick up from Stephen's comments. Not in any particular order, but at the risk of sounding defensive, I just don't want to be verbal here. I didn't say that the aid program is realigning its performance framework with sustainable development goals or intending to do so, anything of the sort. All I mentioned was that how we measure achievements against the goals is something which we will look at in terms of the kind of a potential sort of refresh of the targets. But a new set of targets or a refresh of the targets, that'll be a matter for government, and we'll obviously do sort of consultation before that, but decisions on those will be made by government in due course. On consolidation, again, just to be clear, there's no government strategy to outsource the management of the aid program. We have used in the past facilities arrangements in a number of countries. Sometimes they have worked very well, sometimes we've had issues with them. And we're very conscious of needing to look at the way in which sort of facilities arrangements work and are managed as we use them in other circumstances. Clearly, there are administrative efficiencies in terms of the use of those sorts of facilities, but we're at the moment doing some work internally about the kind of good and better practice in the use of facilities, and we want to make sure that kind of aid program managers within the organisation have access to that when they're kind of looking at new ways of kind of managing their program. So that's sort of some work which is currently going on. Now, the kind of the two main points that I just wanted to pick up on, I think Stephen's made some points about, and I acknowledged it, about where's the bad news? The text contains lots of sort of positive comments, not so many negative comments. That's true, and I think that this is something which we can work harder on next year to try and get some more commentary on those areas where performance didn't meet the expectations that we had of it. But I'd just like to kind of emphasise this isn't sort of like the ABC. This isn't that you've got to have 50% positive comments and 50% negative comments, because clearly if your program is achieving most of its objectives and your investments, most of them are performing effectively, then you're not going to expect that you're going to have a predominance of predominance of positive comment. So, I think the point's reasonably made, and we will look at the kind of the text next year. Now, the last thing that I just wanted to say a little bit on was this question of the scoring and Stephen's graph about effectiveness scores over a period of time. So we have said quite clearly in the report, or ODE have said rather, just treat year-on-year comparisons with a little bit of caution. And we think that's certainly kind of a very wise thing to do. So when you look at kind of the comparison of investment ratings between the years, it is true that at the investment level, five out of six of these ratings went up, and three of them went up by about 6%. And that was quite a significant improvement. And we certainly sat up when we saw those results. You probably need to understand how these results are generated. So 400 plus different aid investment managers across the organisation run effectively a self-assessment process, but a moderated self-assessment process about how their investments are proceeding. So they talk to stakeholders, they look at kind of objective measures of performance for that investment. They generally have a meeting to decide those scores, usually that meeting is kind of moderated by someone out of the line area, but within the department. When we saw these scores, we said, we'd like in some cases, to have another look at these. And in fact, we did go back and we did ask a number of investment managers to review their scores, and a number of scores were changed on the basis of that. We felt that we'd gone as far as we could in terms of querying this improvement, and then it moved on to the process that ODE runs every year, which is kind of an annual independent spot check of the validity of these scores. We felt that there were potentially a few things at play here. Over a period of time, with successive periods of budget cuts, we're certainly aware that programs have been weeding out less well-performing investments. It's a natural thing to do. When you've got less money, you put your money into the things that are performing best. And consolidation, I think, certainly has changed the kind of the portfolio of the program and moved out lower-performing investments. We were also aware that we made a number of big changes to the reporting system during the course of the year, and we did it for good reasons that I'll come to. But we were conscious that there were lots of investment managers who perhaps had not been through this process before. There were lots of supervisors who hadn't were not very familiar with this system. So there were issues to do with the kind of the familiarity with the system. And we did make some changes to the wording of the rating scale that I'll come to. In the end of the day, the independent spot check, the only definite correlation that they could identify was with the changes to the rating scale. So we accept that, and that's clearly acknowledged in the report. But I would just note that this issue of robustness is the evidence there. Clearly, the report says robustness has not deteriorated. The evidence is there for the ratings. What did we do to the rating scale? So you can see on the left-hand side the scale we had in 2014, on the right-hand side the scale we had in 2015. We felt that the scale in 2014 was, in a lot of places, quite subjective. What we tried to do in 2015 was to relate performance back to the kind of the specific criteria of aid quality. Now, how that was applied by 400 individual investment managers across the organisation, we really had no kind of direct control over. We could brief people, we could give guidance to people, but it was a process that runs sort of quite independently. But our feeling was that the changes to the scale were made for good reason, to get more logic into the arrangement, but it is possible that that has caused some scores to go up. The last thing that I just note, so Stephen put up some information about kind of efficiency scores. On the left-hand side, you see the sorts of sub-questions we were asking about efficiency in 2014. On the right-hand side, the sort of questions we were asking about efficiency in 2015. We were asking a lot more detailed questions, many of which went to issues of value for money in 2015. So there were a lot more things which people were assessing the performance against, and they were much more sort of specific than they were in 2014. So there's lots of changes there, but I just wanted to people to kind of understand this gets into the kind of the weeds very quickly, but there are reasons behind the kind of the reasons that, behind why we made these changes to the system. We needed to be able to interrogate data in a much more effective way. We needed to have much more disaggregated data, and so that was the kind of the reason behind the changes that we made to the system. But it may have had some unintended consequences in terms of the level of scores. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much, Scott. We're now moving to the Q&A time. We've got plenty of time for that. I think there are some microphones which are available for people who wish to ask questions. And I think the two panellists are in the process of being mic'd up. Please, when you ask a question, could you briefly introduce yourself and just give us your affiliation? That would just, I think, help a bit. And I think I'm going to exercise the right of the chair and perhaps ask a first question while others formulate theirs. This was one for Scott, who's busily being marked up at the moment, but there was the partner performance assessments were new this year. I would just like to have a little bit more information, perhaps for the benefit of the audience, as to how these are actually done and the level of moderation on these partner performance assessments that have been done for the first time.
Okay, so this was, as I said, a new system that we introduced in the last year. It was part of the changes that the government asked us to make to our performance framework to look at how our aid delivery partners were performing. We've introduced a standard system that applies across our three main categories of partners, non-government organisations, commercial contractors, multilateral organisations. They account for about 75% of kind of the total spend that goes through aid delivery partners. We've got a standard assessment criteria, or format and criteria that applies to all of those partners. It's done once a year. It's done at the same time as the kind of the checks on individual aid investments, but it's looking at performance under the agreements that we have with delivery partners, and it follows kind of a set of sort of standard questions on performance, which cover things like value for money, responsiveness, quality of staffing, etc.
First question.
Yeah, it's Keith Duckwell from Coffee International. Can I pick up on that, Scott? Because there's a process in place, but it goes back to what Stephen was alluding to. There's a lot of change in staff who do PPAs, so I assume that cuts across the board. So even if the process is there, there's a question of the quality in the way that that process is conducted, because it goes to the heart of a lot of the information on these targets. As I suggest, that PPAs and AQCs and FAQCs and APPRs, they're all done by the same people, more or less. And they're probably moderated at a senior level, but they're actually conducted at quite a junior level of staffing generally. So I'm just wondering how, if any work's being done to test that. But by way of example, something you said, which caught my attention, was when you asked for some of those AQCs, I think it was, to be reviewed, I wonder how many of them were moderated as a result of you asking that question.
Well, I can't tell you how many were moderated in 2014. Certainly, we recommended moderation, and we identified moderators and we trained moderators, and many of them did have an independent moderator in those discussions. We've lifted our game on that this year because we wanted to make sure that as much as possible there was an independent voice in the room for this self-assessment process. So we have put senior people into moderation exercise in all the main regions, and we're sort of quite confident that that process is much stronger this year than in the past. I should say as well that this isn't kind of an entirely new system. We built very much on an existing system that applied to our commercial contractors. So we had an annual contractor performance assessment system. We adapted that fundamentally for other different categories of partners, but so we had a consistent system across the board. But it seemed a little bit unfair that we'd been putting our commercial contractors through the ringer with annual performance assessments for many years, but we haven't done the same thing for our NGO partners or for our multilateral partners. So we've tried to even that out now.
Okay, I'm Sarah Moyna from the Office of Development Effectiveness. Stephen, I've just got a quick question about the stakeholder survey, and it's sort of more to the methodology. And we know that surveys can tend to yield somewhat biased responses in that they'll often attract responses from people that have either got something really good that they want to say or really bad that they want to say. And there's ways around that, of course, and I'm not suggesting that that's the case here, but I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you get around that with the methodology. And an additional question about whether or not you've got year-on-year data that you can draw on from methodologically comparable surveys to say whether or not there's something particular happening at the moment.
In fact, we're very happy this week, as well as this event. We're on Thursday, we're going to DFAT to talk about the stakeholder survey, so we're happy to have that chance. Yeah, in terms of the question you ask, which is, you know, the representativeness, yeah, I think that problem we've solved to the best it can be, because we run the survey in two phases. And in the first phase, we have a sampling frame. And the sampling frame are the major NGOs, plus a randomly selected sample of the smaller NGOs that receive aid funding, and the major contractors. And then for each of those, we take, depending on the size, but normally two senior managers. And that is then our sampling frame. And our response rate is about 70%. So it's a pretty good response rate. And so that phase one is representative of the major contractors and NGOs of their management. It's the views of those stakeholders. You know, we then supplement that. That's the first phase. The second phase is then open to anyone. So that's where you get the problem you said, people who are particularly passionate will come online. But yeah, we analyse that separately, and by and large, they're very... Well, it's interesting. At least we've done it now for New Zealand. At least for Australia, those two groups have very similar views. So I don't think it's actually a real problem, but it is a potential problem. It's one we've been able to deal with. In terms of the second point was about the time, our time series. Yeah, so we've done it twice. I mean, it's a major undertaking. We wouldn't do it every year. But yeah, we did it in 2013. Yeah, so just before all the massive changes on the aid program. And then we did it again at the end of last year. So we've done it 2 years apart. And that does make it interesting because you do see massive changes in perception. I mean, that's the most difficult part, is how you interpret that, because obviously people are just unhappy about the fact the aid program has been cut by so much. So how do you interpret what they're saying? And we try to focus on areas that show particularly sharp either upward movement, there aren't any actually, but then particularly sharp downward movement. And we try to tease that out. I think it's very useful from that point of view.
Meg King from the State Society and Governance Melanesia Program. I'm interested, Scott, there's a lot of emphasis on doing better, getting 100% or 90%, but then we actually look at some of the things, agriculture, fisheries, et cetera, are innovative, so they scored well on that, not so well on some of the effectiveness. You'd expect that in a sector that's under severe pressure from climate change, overuse, et cetera. It's different to, say, infrastructure. You'd also expect that in places like gender, where, particularly in the private sector, there's been some trials that haven't worked well, but the learning process has enabled good outcomes. So you want that element of bad and good in the results, and the text has to really bring that out analytically. The second point I'd like you just to comment on is, again, the partnerships, trying to get the most effective partner. But part of development is bringing along partners that may not be so good right now, maybe locally grown, but have high potential. So they may not perform so well initially, but the partnering process might build that. So these deeper questions about evaluation and how they're dealt with in these kind of assessments that are highly quantitative.
I think that's right. I mean, there's nothing that I disagree with there. You know, I don't think we've got an aim to get to 100% on anything. That would be part of compliance. That would be unrealistic. And certainly, you do expect that some sectors are harder to work in than others. The bar is sort of set higher in some cases, and you won't do so well. But I think that you can reasonably expect, for example, that... every investment that we're doing in infrastructure will treat gender equality with the same degree of seriousness as every investment in education, and that's not happening at the moment. So we see that there certainly is kind of room for improvement there. It's well known that kind of agriculture, fisheries, one of the kind of most difficult areas to work across all development institutions. There was a big sort of withdrawal from funding from that sector a few years ago, and in large part because driven by kind of a results culture, the results were often not coming. we're not sort of suggesting kind of withdrawal at all from that area, but I think we do need to look at the kind of effectiveness results that we're getting there, and where we're sort of seeing often a disconnect between agricultural research activities and whether that research is picked up and applied in practice. There is an overall effectiveness and sustainability issue, which I think needs to be looked at, and we can probably do better on. So I think we do need to kind of interrogate the reasons for the differences between sectors in terms of performance and see if there's a story behind it which can lead to, if properly addressed, can lead to improved performance.
Can I just add on that? I mean, just to go back to that issue of the text. You know, I think one way around it is to have, like the text reads as many, many different points, like sort of one sentence each. Just have fewer examples and give them more of a paragraph. Like the APTC would be a good example. You could mention, okay, the evaluation's got mixed findings. But then you could say, you know, DFAT's addressing that, and they are. They're redesigning APTC, and they're trying to think of various ways to improve that labour mobility objective. So, yeah, I think you can still put forward the negatives, but in a way that says, yes, there are going to be negatives and we're learning from them, we're responding to them. Yeah, provided you give yourself enough time, a sort of a paragraph rather than a sentence to explain.
And I wouldn't want to sort of pass without comment that there are a number of negative comments in the report where when Stephen sort of told me that this was a kind of an issue from his perspective, we actually went through and tried to sort of count up. And we could get to kind of, I think, around about sort of 50 examples of negative comments and comments on poor performance. So it's not kind of all spun one way, as people might have.
Are there any more questions? Question over here.
Andrew Roll from Care Australia. Perhaps linking on to a couple of those negatives, two questions. One around investments requiring improvement and that process of, okay, we'll put you in a 12-month cycle and so on. So I think it was about 18 out of about 400, so it's 4 or 5%. That probably sounds about right in terms of what you would expect. But I'd be interested to know if the 18 are telling us anything, like are there particular sectors or particular countries which are coming through as consistently underperforming? Secondly, looking at just some of the geographic graphs around, you know, progress against objectives or benchmarks, you know, there are probably a few countries there which, you know, I can imagine DFAT management looking at that and raising eyebrows around aspects of Timor, Indonesia, PNG. Well, on one hand, you'd expect that those are countries where it's going to be difficult to work and get results, but I'd be interested to know, you know, to findings like these, you know, how does that then translate through to action at the program level in an integrated DFAT on, you know, what's this telling us and what do we need to do about it?
So that fairly sort of complicated set of questions. But on investments requiring improvement, as I said, we're sort of looking at, you know, 1 year after what's happened with those 18. There's no kind of obvious patterns there. They're kind of spread across a range of regions and countries. I think the sorts of factors which often go into why something doesn't do so well apply. Quite often they're quite complicated investments, perhaps ones not very well designed in the first place, sometimes with partners that haven't been worked with before or not haven't been kind of well supervised. So there are probably some kind of themes in there, but they're the same kind of themes that you'd pick out generally from what makes a good investment and what makes sort of something that has problems. The regional variations and country variations, they're inevitable. One of the problems with a sort of consistent format and structure for performance assessments is that you are kind of overlooking the kind of individual circumstances. You can't have it both ways. So there's certainly a reasonable expectation that in some of the kind of most difficult operating environments, performance isn't going to be as strong as in operating environments where you've got kind of strong partners, a strong framework, good governance, good capacity, etc. So those sorts of variations, again, are inevitable, and we don't really try to kind of adjust for them.
Are there any more questions? Yes, yes, there's one at the back here, and there's one here.
Hi, Philippa Smales. I work for the Research for Development Impact Network, formerly known as the Aquid University Network. So I was just curious, in your report and also today, you talk about scope for improvement in terms of monitoring and evaluation. How do you think that impacts on the reporting? And also, is there any concerns raised in terms of that?
So to take them sort of separately, evaluation, we've identified, I think, lots of operational evaluations being done, not so many of them published, and so there is an issue there of just getting that kind of information out and about. But we're also interested in the way in which operational evaluation information is being used within the program. So it has both an accountability perspective and a learning perspective, and we're looking to kind of lift both the kind of the transparency, but also the kind of the utilisation of evaluation findings. Monitoring is a little bit different because this is sort of within the time frame of investments, not kind of when they're finished or just about to finish. One of the kind of principal monitoring systems that we have is this annual aid quality check that a lot of this investment level data comes from. So the compliance with our systems is very high, and we're pleased to see that there's been no kind of fall off in that, despite kind of the significant organisational changes within the department after the integration of AusAid and DFAC. We're very conscious that kind of overall levels of resources for managing a complicated aid program, they're not growing. In fact, they've been significantly reduced over the last few years with periods of budgetary reductions in line with those. So we need to make sure that the kind of the process for monitoring is as simple as possible, so it's as easy to be carried out as possible, and that was part of the reason for a number of the changes that we made to the aid quality check system in order to enable us to continue to do regular annual kind of checks of performance, but to do them in a streamlined way as possible, and to get a set of data from them that we didn't have before, which we could interrogate more extensively.
Question here.
Yes, Neil Forster from DFAC, currently on lead. I found one of the interesting parts of the report was the difference between the ratings at the investment level, which are hovering around 90% for effectiveness, and the ratings of the objectives at the country level, which I've just had a skim, and for example, the Pacific is around 55% in terms of whether the objective is on track or not. So the question I have is that an issue that needs to be discussed, that apparent discrepancy between the investment effectiveness ratings and the ratings as to progress against the objectives of the countries?
So that's a really interesting question and quite a difficult one to answer. I might kind of ask any of our colleagues from the Office of Development Effectiveness if they wanted to comment on that at all, because they do an annual review of the kind of aid program performance reports, which is the program level reporting each year. And I don't think they've found any kind of fall off in quality there, but I'll get them to talk to that if they wish to. But I suppose, by way of explanation, when you're looking at program level objectives, so for a big program like Indonesia, you might have three or four objectives for the entire program. So they aggregate a lot of things across different sectors, a lot of activities within individual sectors. There's a lot more issues of kind of attribution of impact and effect. So in an individual investment context, you might still be scoring quite well, even though kind of the partner isn't performing their share of the burden, and there might be other factors which are intruding, but still in terms of your kind of objectives for that individual investment, you're doing what you said you were going to do. That's much a much less clear picture at the kind of the overall program level, and you will often find that where we've rated or programs have rated objectives as at risk, it's because there are kind of it's a mixed picture. There are a number of things that are happening. It's not necessarily that you're kind of not making any progress at all in that area. It's just that some of the things which you were intending to do perhaps sort of haven't come across quite, haven't been proceeding as well as you might have intended, and so therefore you're rating the overall objective as something that's at risk. But it's not to say that you're not achieving things in that area. It's just a more mixed picture.
Yeah, perhaps could I just add? It's not restricted to DFAT. It's a widespread problem. In fact, it has this name. It's the micro-macro paradox of aid. That when you do the project assessments of aid, it comes out much better than when you do sectoral or countrywide comparisons. And in fact, the World Bank has the same pattern. That their project ratings are up in the 80%, but when they look at their strategic objectives and whether they're being achieved, yeah, it's much closer to the two-thirds or one-half. Yeah, I think it could be for different reasons, but the most common ones are the ones Scott mentioned. I mean, you might, in the project level, you'll be delivering the training, you'll be putting in the advisors, right? You feel you're doing pretty well, but, you know, governance is still not improving, right? Or you're building the health clinics, that's your project, but, you know, there are no drugs, that's someone else's responsibility. So, yeah, you tend to be more ambitious, right, at the program level, right? You're selling your program, right? You're going to transform the Pacific, right? So that ambition comes home, comes back to bite you when you have to do your rating. And that's a problem for projects, but I think it's more severe. The higher up you go, the more ambitious you tend to become.
We're just about out of time, but Simon...
Mainly because Scott asked whether ODU had any comment. We haven't actually, to my knowledge, gone in and systematically, you know, drawn some samples from different country programs and examined what the why there is an apparent disconnect between the two, but certainly one of the technical complications is that we deal with different rating scales. So at the program level, as I think Neil would be well aware, we've got a 3-point rating scale with sort of different definitions of effectiveness. At the investment level, we've got a 6-point rating scale, and they don't exactly correlate. I mean, maybe that's something in the future we need to think about, but it's, I mean, that's a valid observation, but you then really need to dig into the detail on a country-by-country basis to see, in fact, whether there is a disconnect.
Thank you. Well, that takes us to the end of our time. Do either of the panellists have any last remarks they'd like to make? If you don't, only if you've something burning that you haven't said, but all done. So thank you very much. I think it's been a very good session. I think the discussion's been very open and frank, so thank you, and thank you in particular to Scott in terms of your presentation.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.